Blog Talk Radio.
Turn me up a little bit.
Yo, turn radio.
Haha. What you know about it? What you know about it? I said it. Hip-hop, the hip-hop, and you don't stop. I rock on, baby, bubba, to the boogie, baby, the boogie, to the boogie.
What's going
every
on,
week.
Everybody? Whatever.
Nothing much. Every week, you get caught with that song, I tell you.
Hey, it's a nice song. What's
going on,
everybody? This is WTF with Joe D and the lovely and talented Miss Kenitra Jordan. What's going on tonight, partner?
It's almost time for school to start here in North Carolina, i.e. Charlotte, and I'm not ready at all. I have so much stuff to do, and I'm getting frustrated.
Frustrated?
Yeah.
Why are you
getting frustrated? Because some of the classes I have don't really have curriculums, so that means I have to create my own curriculum. And so, you know, that's a little frustrating when you're looking at the students walking in on, you know, the 24th. And I'm the type of person, you know, my former principals will tell you, I usually have the entire year planned out, you know, in June. So for me to be this close to school starting, this close to the children coming back, and I don't have anything planned, you know, not to mention since I changed schools, I don't have a CMS laptop right now. And a lot of these websites that I want to go to, you know, to create my own curriculum, I ain't going to them on my personal laptop, if you know what I mean. So, you know, just kind of feeling behind the eight ball, trying to get everything ready for when the kids come back to school, because I am a perfectionist.
Okay, for future reference, when I asked what the deal was, keep it short and sweet. I'm just saying.
So basically, you're one of those people who ask how you're doing, but you really don't care.
I'm just saying. Short and sweet, please.
Whatever. Pretty much.
Tonight, y'all, we got a great show. This is the Reader's Show. Now, typically, if you listen to our show, y'all know that we usually have authors on, usually two, sometimes more. We're usually two authors on every week, and we showcase their books or whatever, and we give you an opportunity to, you know, to check them out. But this show will be about the readers and what the readers want, what they want in books, what they want to see in their authors, what they don't like about what's going on in the literary world today. So this show is all about the readers. And it should be interesting because we have some people who love to read, and we also have some very opinionated people, Mary Green. We have some people who have their own online book clubs and also physical book clubs. So I think they know what they're talking about, you know. So it should be interesting to find out what they feel about what's going on today in the literary world. But before we get to all of that, we got something that we like to call the spin cycle topic. Okay, Jay, spin the wheel.
Okay. All right. Now, this was posted in the group, and I was so pissed when I read it that I wanted to share it. All right, so apparently this single mother, 26-year-old single mother, four children, Marie Holmes, she won the Powerball lottery, and it was like $188 million. And, you know, but she decided to take it in one lump sum, which is $127 million, and after taxes, $88 million. And everyone was so excited when this single mother of four children won this money, because they were saying, you know, now her children don't ever have to worry about anything again, because they were saying that she was, you know, she could get off of welfare because, you know, she had been on assistance, and and all this other stuff. So people were sincerely happy that she won. I mean, because even, you know, when you boil down to it, $88 million, you still, you're doing good, okay? Well, how about after she won the money, she posted $3 million in bond for her boyfriend, Lamar McDowell. He was in jail facing heroin trafficking charges. And so she bails him out, you know, $3 million bond. I mean, she doesn't even pay, you know, like how they usually say you pay a percentage of that. No, they said she plopped down, you know, a cashier's check or whatever.
Okay, hold on. Let me break, stop you just for a second. The reason why she didn't pay a percentage is because most people don't have their bail, so they go to a bail bondsman. And that percentage is what you pay the bail bondsman. That's why you don't get that money back because you're only paying a percentage. The bail bondsman puts up the rest of the money, and as long as you go to court, he gets his money back, but he keeps that percentage that you paid him. That's how they make their money. See, here's the thing, because I already know, you know.
Can I finish?
Or I'll let you finish, and then I'm going to jump in.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay, so any rate, so she paid a whole $3 million bond for her boyfriend, you know, for heroin trafficking charges. Well, apparently last month the police came to her home and they arrested McDowell again because he had violated the conditions of his bail. And so when they went into the house, and this is her house, when they went into her house, they found him, and he had like a .45 caliber pistol, and, you know, so that additionally violated terms. So she then spent an additional $6 million to get this guy out of jail. And so, you know, of course, you know, she's lashing back out at the media. What y'all need to be worried about is y'all money and not how I spend mine. This is benefiting y'all. How? And no, he's no drug dealer or user, but who are y'all to judge anybody? I will definitely pray for y'all because it is much needed. They talked about Jesus, so I'm not surprised. Y'all are talking about me, but be blessed, though. Really? I'm sorry. I just can't see paying $9 million for somebody. I'm not paying $9 million, period.
That is total BS. Like, okay, let me get this straight. So if your husband was locked up mm-hmm. and it was unsubstantiated in your mind and in his mind, he says he didn't do it. But he has to go, he's locked up because they have him on a bond, on a high bond, and he can't pay it. So you know how that works. You can be arrested for anything, even if you didn't do it.
Uh-huh.
And they will keep you in jail unless you can and make bail. So let's say your husband was locked up for something he didn't do, that he swears up and down he didn't do, and you believe him, and you had the money to get him out, and you wouldn't get him out? Is that what you're saying? Because that's all this woman did. All this woman did was get her. See, here's the thing. Y'all get stuck on the dollar amount. The fact that it's, $9 million. And let's face it, she ain't giving away $9 million. It's a bond. As long as she goes to court, she gets her money back. That's how that works.
Okay, but here's the thing with that, okay? Here's the whole thing with that issue. The second time, okay, so maybe I could see the $3 million the first time, okay? But
do you know how the law works?
Can I finish?
At all?
Let me finish. But he knew he wasn't supposed to have a gun. So you tell me why he's sitting in her house with a gun knowing that violates.
Really? Because he's been because he lives a certain lifestyle. He's been in a certain life. There are people who, there are plenty of fellas walking around carrying guns that ain't supposed to be carrying a gun. You know why? Because they live in an environment where if they ain't got no gun, they might not come home that night.
Well, I'm just saying. I wouldn't have paid the second time.
That's just bottom line. And she probably understands that. He's probably been a gun carrier. Did he use it, or was it just at her house?
Well, no,
it was just at her house.
You know that's a violation of your term.
So what? People did it all the time. You ain't supposed to speed, but people speed. I mean, come on, y'all. I think people are making too much about the dollar amount. Suppose it was $9,000, so she shouldn't have paid that? I mean, and think about it. This woman just won $88 million. What's $9 million to her? It's $88 million. It's not like she won $20 million and spent $9 million getting her man out of prison or jail. And let's
I'm
look deeper. Why was he under a $6 million bond to begin with? Don't you think they jacked up his bond just so she would have to pay it because they knew she was going to pay it?
I'm probably sure they did jack it up to try and keep him back in, you know, where he belonged if he was doing all that
stuff. What you mean where he belonged? How do you know he said he's innocent and he didn't do it?
Okay,
see,
whatever.
He explicitly states that he is innocent. So just
okay.
because he's arrested, you try to tell me he's guilty?
I'm saying I'm not paying $9 million.
Yes, you would. If that was your man, yes, you would. Yes, you would.
No, the hell I would not.
Okay, so, all right, so let me get it straight. So if you was the one sitting in there falsely accused, you wouldn't want your man to pay your $9 million bond?
No, I wouldn't expect him to put
yeah,
that kind
right.
of money up for me.
Yeah, right, okay.
I would
so
not.
So you just go sit up in there. You're going to sit up in there knowing
I
you ain't doing nothing.
I left out the best part. They actually did find heroin on him when they went into her home. So, hell no, I would not have paid the $6 million. You got me once with the $3 million. I'll be damned if you're going to get me with the $6 million. And you brought
really?
That shit around my kids? Excuse my language.
How did you know it wasn't hers and he took the rap for it? See, that's what I'm talking about. Like, y'all have
Girl,
no clue how people work. You have no clue how couples work. How do you know it wasn't her stuff, her hair? How do you know she wasn't no heroin at it? Or she did stuff on the little side, and he was like, well, she just got this money. Let me go ahead. I got a record. Let me go ahead and take this rap. How do you know that didn't happen? That does happen. So how do you know that didn't happen? And
we
he knew, hey, and he knew, and in the back of his mind, he's like, well, my baby got the money. She ain't going to let me sit. So I go
We're
ahead and take the rap.
We're going to agree to disagree.
Whatever.
Yeah, move on to your topic.
My topic, for all you sports fans out there, the NFL is back. Preseason,
Panthers.
Anyway, forget the Panthers. But the Panthers indirectly have a little bit to do with my spin cycle topic. Remember the other day Cam Newton got into a fight with some other player. I think it was some little cornerback. I don't even remember his name. But he got into a fight with this guy, and he got into a lot of media trouble because people were like, you're the quarterback. You shouldn't be getting in a fight with anybody because you're jeopardizing the team. Nothing really went down. You know what I'm saying? It was just kind of like pushing and shoving, talking smack to each other. And that was it.
I think he insulted Cam's Capri.
And so, anyway, and so everybody came down on Cam Newton. Because what could have been? What would have happened if he had gotten hurt getting into a fisticuff altercation when he should have just let it go?
Fisticuff.
So, but nothing happened. But another fight happened, not with the Panthers.
The Jets.
This time it was the Jets and Geno Smith.
Yeah.
Got his jaw broken in two places. My spin cycle topic is just what the hell was Geno thinking? Everybody want to blame, I can't pronounce his name, but his nickname is IK. Everybody wants to blame IK. Because he hauled off and punched Geno in the jaw. Well, guess what came out after the fact? Come to find out, Geno owed a man about $600. Geno was supposed to go to this man. This man had a camp for kids. It was a charity camp for kids in his hometown where he played high school football. Then Geno was supposed to come. He was his guest, and that's what he promoted and everything. There was a death in Geno's family or friend or something, and he couldn't make it. Okay, that was warranted. But the guy had already paid for the plane ticket and everything. So anyway, they go to minicamp. Geno doesn't get him in. Geno's supposed to reimburse the man his money. Now, take into consideration, IK is a six-round draft choice. He ain't making it for so much money. And they say he's tight with his money. Very smart man. Geno is a starting quarterback for the New York Jets. Millionaire. You can't pay the man back his $600? 2 weeks had gone by. And reportedly, they had a confrontation, and Geno got in his face, put his finger in his face, and said, pretty much, you'll get your money when I give it to you, if I give it to you. Now, I'm not condoning violence, but there's certain things you don't say to a man unless you're ready to throw some hands. One of them is, you ain't going to get your money unless I want to give you your money. What did he think was going to happen? All this stuff about him being sucker punched because the media got a hold to it and they claim, oh, the guy just walked up to him and sucker punched. No, that's not what happened at all. It was a confrontation. He put his hand in the dude's face and the dude cold cocked him.
Cold cocked
him? What's up with that? Like, I don't see Tom Brady getting in scuffles like that. I don't see Peyton Manning getting in scuffles like that. I don't see Aaron Rodgers, the bad man that he is, getting in scuffles like that. What does Cam Newton and Geno Smith have in common? Black quarterbacks. Why, oh, why can't we just understand protocol when it comes to certain things? You're the quarterback. Act like it. You're the leader. Act like it. He was supposed to defuse that. It should have never came down to a six-round draft choice asking him, yo, man, where my $600 at? You're the quarterback. You're the leader. You're the leader of men. And thankfully, as a side note, because I just found this out, IK got picked up by the Bills because it was a talk that he would never play football again just because he punched Geno in the jaw. So the moral of the story is, when you owe somebody some money, pay them that money if you got it. And if you don't have it, don't hide. Just tell them, I ain't got it, yo.
Well, then if that's the case, Jody, that money I owe you, I ain't got it. I'm sorry.
That's all good. We can work that off. We can work that off another way. I can put you on the stroll. It's all good. So what is your final topic?
Busta Rhymes, man, he's in trouble. He's wanted for questioning because he supposedly threatened somebody. This woman named Kim Simpson threatened her after the BET Awards. So apparently, they accidentally, Kim and a friend of hers accidentally bumped into him while they were dancing at the award show, and they apologized, but they said Busta went off and told them, I'll bite you, and not that kind of bite. Oof. And so they said, it escalated even further when they were taking pictures with ex-reality star Chandra Delish, or Delicious Davis or something like that.
Oh,
and
Delicious.
Somehow,
yes.
Okay, well, apparently you know who that is. But apparently the flash went off, and he got caught, like, in the camera flash crossfire. So then he started going towards them, talking about some don't make me slap you. And he spat at them and then started charging at them from across the room, but he was stopped by a security guard. So the police are trying to find him at this point so that they can, interview him. And they were saying that they haven't heard anything from Busta, who's real name was Trevor Smith. They haven't heard anything from Smith's attorney, and he hasn't, commented or said anything, Busta himself. But they were saying this isn't the first time that he's been accused of lashing out at strangers. It says something about last week he actually was arrested for throwing a 17-ounce strawberry protein drink at a Manhattan gym employee's head. So that's why I was like, dang, Busta, sounds like he needs to put his hands where my eyes can see. I tell you.
Really? Well, what's he suffering from, like roid rage or something?
Or maybe just the rage of nobody knows who he is anymore. I don't know.
Really?
You know how it is. Yeah, you know how it is when people get old, Jody. I mean, come on. You're old.
No, I don't know that. I only hear rumors from you. The rumor is you fart dust. So, I mean.
Did you say I fart dust? Really?
You tell me what it is to get old.
You better chill, because you're going to be stuck in a car with me on the way to Atlanta this weekend. So you better chill.
At any rate, yes,
and I mean that. Huh. So at any rate, we will be right back with our very, very special.
I didn't get a chance to give my take on Busta.
I know.
Never mind.
Sometimes I don't want to know what you have to say. I mean, you know, it's just safer for the environment sometimes if we just kind of keep you quiet.
Anyway, we'll be back, y'all, after this.
And we are very proud to announce to you that Washed in His Blood, the very first novel to drop on our label, Jokin Publications, is up and running and is live in the Amazon store for you. He was a foster child, ruined by the system, betrayed by the very system that was supposed to protect him. And now he's back. And those who failed to protect him then will be the ones needing protection now. You can find Washed in His Blood at Amazon.com for purchase, either in paperback or as a Kindle. Happy reading.
Now, my second ad is just going to have to be spoken. I'm so sorry to break protocol. But I recently upgraded to Windows 10, and so therefore my ads are no longer compatible. So at any rate, we just want to let everybody know that we will be in the Atlanta, Georgia area this coming weekend on Saturday at Nubian Bookstore, which is located at 1540 South Lake Parkway, and that is in Morrow. I know, right? That is in Morrow, Georgia, and we will be there from 5 until 8 o'clock. So if you are in the area and you just really want to, you know, for some reason come out and smack Jody, he'll be there, and he'll stand still long enough for you to do that for him. And I will be there just to look lovely and be the trophy partner. Yay! You know, kind of do my princess wave.
Really?
What?
Anyway.
I do a princess race. I think someone's at the door. Oh, my doorbell. That sucks.
Really, you played the applause before I could even say, come on in. But anyway, come on in, y'all.
Too slow. All right, so we have Mary Green. Say hello, Mary.
Hi.
Hello,
Mary Green.
We have Marie, are you there?
Oh, you mean Maurice? Hi.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Okay.
Michael Carter, are you there?
Right here.
Okay. And Jacqueline, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Hello.
So, this show is about you guys, readers, readers' choice. What is it that, or I guess I should say, what is a big difference that you have noticed occurring in the industry lately? Have you noticed anything at all?
That's really... Okay, go ahead. Okay, I'll go.
Maurice, I'll go. I've noticed a lot. I live in New York, so I see a lot of people on the subways and buses with Kindles, but I also see a lot of people with, they're still using regular books. And what I find is that, for me personally, I like the regular book. The Kindle I've tried and I don't like it. It doesn't give me a real feel. And people I've spoken to have said the same thing. So I think that what's happening is that we're going back to regular books. We're moving away from Kindles.
Lord, I hope so.
I know I do.
Mary Green, what do you think about that?
I actually prefer the Kindle books. For me, because I would always carry around multiple books at a time, and that was a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, at work, it's easier for me to sneak and read a Kindle book than to actually read a paperback. And so when I read a paperback at home, by the time I get home from work and doing everything else, I'm like halfway ready for bed, so I'm not reading.
Okay. That makes sense.
That makes sense.
Jacqueline, how about you?
I'm actually a little bit of both. I think I like the feel of the book itself, but my Kindle holds so much more that I don't have the opportunity to go to the bookstore or to the library to check out my books. So I kind of like, I'm in between. I like both, but I like the Kindle because it holds more.
Okay.
I understand that. That for me, I've always been a reader, so I have like a library at my house, literally,
right.
Just books upon books. And I resisted the whole Kindle thing. Like I'm old school. Like Kenitra teases me about being old school, but trust me, I'm old school.
Mm-hmm.
And I resisted the Kindle for a while, but I'm gonna tell you, once I started download books, it is like smoking crack. I mean, I'm just saying,
yeah.
It is addictive, you know. So I got like multiple books on my Kindle now. That I haven't even read. I think that's the problem, though. The problem is that you can get so many books, there's so many books out there, and they're just at your fingertips, and they just sit because you're on to the next one, on to the next one, on to the next one. Whereas it seems
right.
like when I used to buy books, physical books, I'd always read them, you know, come home, start reading. It didn't sit, you know?
Right.
But I'm like Jacqueline, I do a little bit of both. I kind of juggle.
Pat, what do you think?
Hey,
Pat?
Hey,
oh,
can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh. Hey, hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi.
I'm just like Jody. I like to open a book. I like to have books, physical copies. But the thing is with the Kindle books those come in handy to where you can pretty much read them anywhere at any time. You know, if you're somewhere like just visiting folks and you're sitting off the cut, while they're talking the talk, you just whip it out and, you know, don't have to worry about the lighting or anything, you know. Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're there.
Yeah. So, but I prefer physical books. And like Jody said, to me, when he was saying about you have many copies or downloads on your device and they're not getting read, and to me, you know, if I was thinking as an author thinks, I want my books to get read. So
right.
I'd rather have one person to have a physical book and they read it and love it and talk about it to 10 more people versus
mm-hmm.
10 people downloading my book and only one or two of them read it.
Right. Well, nowadays you can get 10 people to download your book and they haven't read it, but they downloaded it.
They downloaded it, but I really think when people read it, that's when your book is getting publicity.
Yeah.
Right now people just know it's there, it's out, but they don't know the story. As an author, I want people to know my story, not just know I have a book out.
Exactly.
Right. I get that, and as an English teacher, it took me a while to move from, you know, the physical book to the Kindle, but the way the transition happened for me was it just got so overwhelming because a lot of times in the school district, you don't have enough books for every single class you teach. So, you know, you would have like 30 copies. So I would have three, you know, bins of 30 books for my classes, and that meant I was carrying around three novels plus a teacher's edition of the actual textbook, you know, because your whole class is not going to just be from the novel. So for me, going to the Kindle or the Nook is what I have. Hate it, sorry. But anyway, I'm just putting it out there for Christmas. I'm putting it out there for a Christmas gift, you know. Kindle. So anyway, going to the e-reader, we'll just say it like that, gave me the opportunity to carry multiple of my students' books or the books that I teach on one device and not have to be cumbered with this humongous book bag that was making me start to walk like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. So I'm all Kindle
anyway.
Now. Yay. Shut up.
Did you say it made you walk like the Hunchback of Notre Dame? Did you ever get over that? I'm just saying. But anyway, I got a question for Mary Green. Mary Green.
Yes.
Is part of the first book club, online book club that I ever joined. Okay. Just Read Book Club. Actually, it was the first club I ever joined on Facebook, because I wasn't a Facebook person. Pat can tell you that. I used to talk down to people that was on Facebook all the time. But my question is, I've noticed ever since I've been a part of Just Read that Mary always, like, she critiques books and everything. So tell us, what is it that you look for in a book, and what makes it good and what makes it bad, in your opinion?
Well, I look for characters that are developed, a good storyline. Personally, I love a book that has a crazy chick or a crazy guy. Like, if somebody is delusional, I'm loving it because it's different. It's not the same.
I'm going to kill you, Mary Green. Go ahead. I'm going to kill you, but go ahead.
And I look for editing. Like, I can't, if I have to stop every 5 seconds to figure out what's going on, then that's not a good book. I can't do it. I'll stop reading it. If it's slow and a lot of name dropping, I'll stop reading it too. Or label dropping.
Oh, that's a good point, the whole label dropping.
I'm just saying, Mary Green, Sugarland. I'm just saying. You like crazy people? You like fast pace? Just saying.
I'm going to try it one day. I'm going to get back into it.
See, I have a standing joke with Mary because Mary has been one of my biggest supporters from day one. But she has yet to read my book. This is the interesting part. She has pushed my book and pushed it and pushed it and pushed it, but never has read it because she thinks it's erotica. I keep telling her it's an erotic thriller. It's not erotica. It has a little bit of sex in it, but not, you know, it's not just a sex book.
Yeah,
okay. But I understand.
Well, if you like deranged people, then you definitely need to pick up Wash, because he's killing people left and right in that one. That's my current one. So, but at any rate.
people going to think me crazy because all we do is write about killers, but I'm just saying. Jacqueline, tell me what you think about, what do you look for in the book? What's good? What's bad? In your opinion.
When I get into a book, it's usually because it's fast-paced, the story is well-developed, the characters are well-developed, and it's a different take on an old story idea.
Oh, cool.
So you don't mind the same storylines, you just want them told differently.
Correct.
Okay. Maurice, how about you?
Like the other two, I like a well-developed storyline. I'm not into too much of the killing and thrilling. I'm more erotica.
Okay.
I like a book where I feel when I'm reading it, I become part of the book. For me, that's a good book.
Cool.
If I don't become part of the book, it's a slow book. It'll take me forever to finish it. But if I feel like I'm like a character, I'm watching it like a movie, and I got to find out what happens next, for me, that's a good book.
Yes, I agree. Michael Carter?
Yes, sir.
Jump on in. What you think?
Well, getting back to when you were talking about the Kindles, I'm old school. I like books. But I think that, the Kindles are going to be here to stay, and I think that the 30 and unders are the one who are going to bring them through.
Yeah.
Because that generation, that's what they know. They're computer literate. That's what they were raised with. So I think, they'll be the ones, will be the ones who are going to use Kindles and make sure that they're here to stay. As far as, last question, when I read, I just like a good storyline, something that'll keep the pages turning. I like a good love story. Like a good action story. I like erotica. I like good character development. I like for things to be explained. I don't like to end a book and wonder, well, what happened to so-and-so, or, you know, this didn't get explained, you know, and for them to leave you hanging if there's not, like, a part two or, you know, sequel to it.
Now, that's something that Mary talks about a lot. Mary, you always talk about, what is it, that they have umpteen numbers of sequels within their series, or how they leave you hanging at the end, or how they'll just, you know, get to the point where one book is priced this amount, then each book they keep going up in price. Is that a new trend that you've noticed happening with series?
Newer. Even though I'm still young, I've been, like, reading and the urban fiction and all that since I was probably in middle school, and I never noticed, like, I would see sequels, like, 17 books, and then start at 19. It would be, you know, all the books would be around the same price, but it, in the newer last few years, I think that it's definitely changed with the sequels and the prices going up with big.
So what do you all got? I mean, what do you all think? Do you all prefer series, or do you guys prefer standalones? Because I know I've seen a lot of readers make the comments that no one writes standalones anymore, that everybody is trying to do series. So what do you guys prefer? You guys, not
Pat,
everybody
else. Pat, you take that.
Yeah. I really like if you could take a standalone and spin a couple of characters out of it into a totally different story. You know, I think that creates talent in the author. But, anything you get a piece of, you want some more. So anytime you read a good book, of course you're going to want more. You know, well, at least that's my theory. But if you could get a standalone and it was good and deep and solid, you know, I'm satisfied with it.
Okay. What do you think?
Oh, wait a minute. But I also wanted to say what I think was what makes a good book is when it's the in-depth detailing. The books that has intense detailing, if it's spaced out, I think that's what makes a good book. Some authors do a lot of detailing, like back to back to back, kind of takes away the story, and I'm quick to kind of close it, you know. But I wanted to squeeze that in too, because y'all was talking about that earlier.
I know exactly what you mean. I always say that when you put too much detail in it, and you give details that have nothing to do with nothing,
right,
it makes the story boring. I mean, it just bogs it down.
I like
when
what Mary always says. Mary says
when you tell me,
and
Mary would tell you, I always agree with her when she says that. When you tell me mm-hmm. you a character walked into a room and there was cigarettes on the table and a wine glass and the curtains were shuffling and ruffling in the wind and all that, but it has nothing to do with what's going on. I'm like, why?
Right, it's unless it's going to come back in another, you know.
Exactly. Unless there's a reason why the curtains are ruffling because there's a storm outside or something. Or unless there's a reason why there's something on the table that you're going to come back to. But more often than not, it doesn't have anything to do with the story. I think when I read books, that is the one thing I look for. I look for, like Jacqueline said earlier, I look for pace. I like a quick pace. And a steady pace, but I also look, because to me, that when I see somebody who writes and they put all this detail and this descriptive stuff in it, it denotes a level of amateur to me. I mean, it you only see like beginners doing that really. I feel like when you really have a command of your writing style, your stuff just flows. Like, I can read people's, you know, I can read certain people's stuff, and it just flows. And they may get in that there's a cigarette box on the table or the curtains were ruffling, but they get it in the flow of the story, so it doesn't seem bogged down. But it seems like novices, they just try to put all this stuff in there, and it doesn't mean anything.
What do you
opinion.
Think about that, Michael?
I'm... again, I think I touched on it, you know, earlier about, you know, I just like, I'm not opposed to detail, and I have to agree with Joe, just as long as it has to do with the storyline, not something doesn't need to have too much detail, but I hate it when it doesn't have enough.
Right.
You know, I like I said, I like for things to be explained. Every story, everything about the story should be explained. You know, so that's why I am with the detail aspect.
Yeah, details are cool. I mean, my thing is intense details where they go down to the stripes on your shoelaces. You know. The Jordans are fine. I don't need to know about the shoestrings on the Jordans. You know what I mean? I mean, some people, y'all think I'm, but it's in some books.
Yeah, it is.
No, the detailing like that works when you're writing for film or for TV or for visual.
Okay.
But because I write for, you know, for visual purposes, for film and stuff like that. So the detailing is what, you know, like when I watch something on TV and I notice that the camera will show something not out of focus, but out of the scene that they're getting ready to show. And
mm-hmm.
I know that they're going to draw the story back to whatever they're showing. So it's a telltale sign that, you know, that it's a predictor kind of thing that happens in storytelling, that this is important
right.
to the story, so it's going to come
right.
back. Yes, and I agree. Most times, sometimes it doesn't even come back to what they were talking about in the detail. And that's where I get a little crazy. Like, what?
Right.
And
I agree with that.
I will submit this as well. Too much detail. You have to leave something to the reader's imagination. You know, I think that it insults the reader when they can't apply their imagination because,
right,
you
right.
know, even as a writer, like when you describe a room, you see it your way, but in their mind, they're going to see it their way.
I don't like music.
Reading is the escape.
And
right.
I think there's a huge difference between script writing and novel writing.
Yep.
Yeah,
it makes sense. Yeah, it makes sense to put in a lot of detail when you're writing scripts.
Right.
It also makes sense to put in some detail when you write a novel. It's just the way you go about it. I think what Pat was saying earlier, it's kind of like how you go about telling the details or revealing the details. Don't just throw them out, you know, like you're throwing jacks or something on the floor. Kind of give them in a creative way. So people are like, you know, they're using their brain as they're reading these, you know, the scene. Because
right.
just like Michael Carter said, you want them to use their imagination. You don't want to leave out all the details, but you still want the reader to use their imagination and let them form their own scene in their head, you know.
Right.
Exactly.
That's what works for me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now we have somebody on the line. I'm going to go ahead and bring them in and see. Hi, caller. Did you want to ask a question or you want to jump in the conversation?
I just want to join in on the conversation.
Okay. Well, introduce yourself. Who are you?
This is Clever Black. How y'all doing?
Oh, Lord.
What's going on?
Hello.
Mary, I'm sorry.
How y'all doing?
I didn't know, Mary.
I had to come on when Mighty Mouse was on the phone. You know, she
oh,
back
Lord.
Down. No.
I'm so sorry, Mary. I did not know the number.
For all you people out there, this is Clever Black, the author of the Holland series, the very successful series, I might add, and a host of other books. But
and he'll be on the show later this month on the 26th.
Yeah. So
looking forward.
You got a question for Mary Clever?
Not really. Yeah, I got one. You know, when she gonna make me a lead administrator? Nah, really though, I really wanted to talk about the scenes in the book. When early on, when I was writing, I come across a blog. I can't even remember the author that wrote the blog, but this particular author said that sometimes, you know, as far as when you're developing characters, a house or a building, you know what I'm saying, a particular area can also become a character in a story. So when writers write about and they set up a certain scene and they describe a building, it could be with the intent of them having many scenes playing out in that particular area. You know what I'm saying? And I think she used the context of a dungeon. A particular author, I think her name is, I want to say Karen Slaughter. She writes these kind of serial killer type of books. And she would always set up the scene with a dungeon, an underground cave or something like that, wherever the serial killer was taking their victims. So when she go back to that scene, you have an idea of what it's looking like, you know, inside that dungeon. Because that particular location becomes a character in the book.
But that's different, though, Clever, because remember they were saying, like, how you tie it back. And what you're saying that author is doing, they're definitely tying everything together there.
Right. And that's all I wanted to contribute to the conversation, really, that sometimes, like Jordan was saying, a lot of times, in the beginning phases, a lot of authors come up because they be trying to add too much. They have so much that they want to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And they try to explain everything when it's not really necessary.
Yeah.
Because what they're describing really has no relevance to the story overall, when it's more about the characters and not the location.
Exactly.
You know, but sometimes describing a certain, you know, and that was something that I took from that blog, that you can actually you know, you could take buildings, locations, rather than a person or a character, and make that a part of the story as well. You know, and I tend to do that. And then when you're writing, you know, when you're writing, if you're setting up a scene, there's something going to go down. You know what I'm saying? If you get into a dramatic part inside the story, when something is about to go down, and you're describing an action scene, you might want to set it up so when the characters are moving around inside that scene, you kind of get a visual of where they're going, instead of just, you know, somebody walked into a certain building, you know, and just started opening fire. You don't know what the place looked like, how they're moving, where the character's moving.
Right.
You know, somebody hiding behind this, so you would describe the scene, kind of set it up. You know what I'm saying? And like I said, I understand what was being said, but a lot of times those objects, you know what I'm saying, can play a significant role inside of a story. You know, that's just my take on it.
I definitely agree with that. I just, to me, everything you write, it should move the story forward, to me. That's the way I was taught. Like, when you, and I, you know, I fell victim to that. When I first started writing, I fell victim to describing everything, too. I think everybody does at some point, you know, when you first start. Now, that's why I said it seems like that's when you're a novice, when you're a beginner, you're just starting out. You tend to do those things, but after a while, you know, through trial and error, you find out what works and what doesn't work.
Right.
But I definitely agree with it. If you have an object that they describe and then they come back to it later and it makes sense, it might not make sense when they first describe it, but when they come back to it later, and they, you know, referenced it, and you're like, oh, okay, that's why they did what they did. To me,
right,
that makes sense. But a lot of times, people just describing stuff. Like, they throwing out labels and you know, what the car, what kind of car it is, and down to the model and the engine. You know what I mean? How many horsepower it got. Yeah, I'm saying. Like, some of that just, to me, it bogs the story down. But I have another question for y'all. What do y'all think about the proliferation of Amazon and its effect on the literary world right now? Michael Carter,
that y'all have
that one to you.
Well,
You know, certainly from an author standpoint, it makes your work accessible. And then tying that with the e-readers, then, you know, it makes it that much more accessible to, you know, for people to be able to, you know, to find your work. I don't really have much more to, you know, to add to that. It's, you know, Amazon is
but
like...
But do you like it? That's what I'm trying to get at. Do you like it?
I like it, again, because, you know, of the accessibility.
Okay.
You know, that it has to, you know, to... Cause the first thing people ask me, are your books available on Amazon? And,
yeah.
You know, at this stage in life, if you can't say yes, you're behind the curve, pretty
yeah.
much.
But do you think they have a monopoly on the literary world right now? Like, don't get me wrong. To me, it's almost like Amazon is a necessary evil. And
yes.
I call it an evil because, to me, they have totally destroyed the literary world. And I'm going to tell you why.
Okay.
Because there's no vetting system on Amazon. Everybody is pretty much the same. There are millions upon millions upon millions upon millions of authors. There's thousands of authors that drop every hour. There's no vetting system. So a very, very good author is the same in Amazon's eyes as somebody who can't write a lick, but yet they get the same billing. I think if Amazon really, really cared about selling quality work, they would have a vetting system, but they don't. So now, I feel like a lot of people just get fooled. You know what I'm saying? Like in Just Read, I remember when I first joined Just Read, I used to see a lot of members always talk about bad books that they got. You know, they complain about like the errors and you know the book just didn't make sense, or the book on the inside didn't match the synopsis, or the writing was atrocious, but it had a great cover. You know what I mean? It had a great cover, but the book itself was just crap. And I feel like that's what Amazon has done. Amazon has created this world. Why do you guys have a great cover?
Well,
people will buy your stuff, but it's crap. Go ahead.
I can't put that all on Amazon because you have some authors that have a huge fan base. So even if Amazon is like, oh, this book is crap, you got somebody that has a fan base of millions of readers that's going to say otherwise. So as long as those millions of readers say otherwise, it's not going to matter what Amazon says.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, like, to me, if you got millions, a fan base of millions of readers, then you're probably not putting out crap.
Oh, but it is some. It is some that's doing it.
But to me, I'm just saying that Amazon doesn't care about the quality of what they sell. Like, you can't go into, okay, here's what I'm going to say, and I'm going to just let somebody else get it. But you can't walk into Barnes & Noble, for the most part, and buy a book that's just riddled with errors. You just can't. Because they have a vetting system. They go through all that stuff. That's not to say that you can't walk into Barnes & Noble and buy a book that's not that good. But there's going to be, but there's a certain level of excellence that you have to have just to get in there. My problem with Amazon is they let everybody in. They don't care.
No, because they're going to throw up against the wall, and whatever sticks sticks, and what doesn't stick.
But sometimes you get lost.
Sticks.
I mean, like, okay, I can have a barrel full of apples, and there's some good apples, but most of them are bad. Yeah, you could throw some good apples in there, and you could say, well, you know, you have a chance to find that good apple. But it's in a sea of bad apples. So I got to sit there and eat a bunch of bad apples first.
But the question is, are people going to come back and buy another barrel of apples?
Yes.
No, they won't.
They will.
But the problem is, I got to eat that bad apple first. I don't want to have to eat the bad apple.
I know. I understand your point, but again, you know, it's you know, people stay in business, and whatever business they do, they stay in business because the customers keep coming.
That's
and
true.
If the customers keep coming to Amazon, Amazon's going to stay in business. You know, somebody's living in a great big old house because of what they sell on Amazon. You know, it's as simple as that. They could care less whether or not the books are good. They're there to sell the books. They're not there to sell good books. They're there to sell books.
I'm not defending Amazon.
You know, don't get me wrong. I'm not defending them. I'm just trying to be practical and you know, be realistic about it. And what
have like they got a monopoly on the literary world, but that's just me.
And it's not going to go away.
I like Amazon personally. You know, I mean,
why do you guys
I always?
I like Amazon.
I just look at it like the typewriter and the 45. Remember the 45, man? You had to put that little plastic piece on the turntable.
Yeah.
To hold that 45 in place. You know.
You going way back.
And, yeah, way back. And 45 was the joint. Then they come out with that mixing board. Now you can hook up two turntables and you can play two albums at the same time. You know what I'm saying? Then the 8-track started panicking. Oh no! You know when the cassette tape come out, and then you got the now you got the CDs coming out. You know what I'm saying? So when the 8-track fell by the wayside to the cassette player felt like, you know, okay, we got it dominated now until the CDs came out, and the CDs was the journey until everybody can start downloading their music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same thing that Amazon is doing, you know. Now, as far as the books, they got the thing now when you get paid per page read. So if somebody picks up your book, if they're in that Kindle Unlimited, and they're reading your book and they decide that they don't want to, you know, your story is not, you know, suiting to their taste, they can delete it right out, you know. They can delete it right out. You got a 300-page book. Maybe they read 60 pages of it and decided that it wasn't for them, and they could just so instead of you getting paid for that entire book, you know what I'm saying? You only get
mm-hmm.
paid for 60 pages read.
Right.
So that has a way of kind of washing things out. You know what I'm saying? That's just me and how I feel about it. I kind of like what's going on now, but on the flip side, it's the thing that. And I don't know, Kenitra, Jordan, you know, Uncle Pat, Mike, y'all, if y'all making more off of paperbacks, because y'all going from hand to hand, and y'all out there every day,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it's certain authors and certain publishers that they make a killing off of paperback. You sell a paperback for $15, and,
yeah.
you know, you maybe get $2-3 off it, depending on how many pages on that book. You know what I'm saying? You might
mm-hmm.
be able to flip your money on that book, but it depends mm-hmm. on how many pages according to the print on that book. But they
right.
can take that same book, you know what I'm saying, and set it at a lower price and sell it on the digital side, and they gonna make just as much off the royalty as they were in the paperback. And that ebook is selling quicker than the paperback, so they have incentive to go digital. And, you know, to be honest, that's just the way technology is going right now.
Yes. And if you don't
you know?
Have your books as digital capability, again, you're behind the curve, you know, and it's not you're not going to be able to compete, you know.
I will say this, though. I think
you can compete because the paperback market is still there. I mean, actually, it's a hunger for it.
Yeah. I'm going to be honest with you. We make more money off paperbacks than we do off ebooks. I think for
and
a new author. I think for
Jordan,
a new author. I said, "What? Go ahead, Clubber."
Nah, I know that. I know that. I'll be watching, and I know that.
Because we settle.
You know,
I mean,
yeah.
People want to engage with the author, and they feel like they're not getting duped. I hate to use the word duped, but they feel like if they engage with you, a lot of times nowadays people buy for personality. They don't even care what you wrote. You know what I'm saying? If they like Clever Black or if they like Michael Carter or Jacqueline or Kenitra, if they just like them as a person, I'm going to go buy their book. It sounds ridiculous, but that's what happens nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they read it and it's good, okay, well, now you got a mouthpiece because now they out there telling everybody about your stuff. But a lot of times people like that personality. That's why we sell, like
ebooks, to me, the only thing you can do to push ebooks is just, I guess you promote in different groups and you just keep putting your link out there or whatever, and you hope somebody get it. And then through word of mouth, you know, somebody say, oh, I heard about the Holland series, you know, such, 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 and such. And so somebody will click it. And then somebody will one click it here. And then they'll tell somebody, and then they'll one click it there. So I get it. I get it's easier to reach more people with the ebook because it's global. You know what I mean? But to me,
right.
It's easier for me to make money with the paperback.
But see, that's,
because
that's
it literally costs. It literally costs. Four, sometimes $3 and some change to print up a book that I can sell for $15. So you do the math on that. You know what I mean? And
yes.
You push it, and every time you go out, you selling your paperbacks.
Right.
So to me, it's easier to sell paperbacks than it is ebooks because I haven't figured out the whole internet game just yet. You know what I mean? I see some people that, like, they do well with those ebooks and more power to them because they figured it out. But to me, it seems like when you go face-to-face with somebody, they tend to try you. Especially I'm speaking as a new author. Like, Clever and them are established, so it's a little bit different. You got a certain amount of fan base. So they're going to get your stuff regardless. But when you're just starting out, you got to connect with some people. You know what I mean? Or you got to get lucky to have somebody like Mary Green help push your book. You know, that has her own
even with
online
that,
book club.
So with that, even with that said, though, you still able to make a living off of selling the paperbacks.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
And see for certain authors, the conundrum comes in when you go to print. And they're telling you it's based on the amount of pages.
Mm-hmm. And it
you know, is. It's based on the amount of pages. So in order for me to get that $3 price, you know, I would have to print up maybe 2,000 books. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. A wise
so
we
looking
man
at
6,000. Told me, print up as many books as you can. I don't care if you got to get a loan. I don't care if you got to sell your car.
right,
said, print up as many books as you can because the more books you print, the more books you sell.
Right.
That's the thing.
But the thing is, here, you know, if you got a secondary job like I do, that means I'm going to have to move around.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because I drive 18-wheelers, so that means every morning I get up, I got to put about 3 or 4 cases on the back of that trailer with the load
mm-hmm.
that I'm carrying, and I got to off them books also. So I can have them 2,000 books, but can I get rid of them in a timely fashion?
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? That's where for certain authors, you know, it's different avenues. To me, it's really no particular way, you know, for an author to have a fan base. You know what I'm saying? Or to establish their name. You know what I'm saying? Or to even sell their story. It's no particular avenue because what works for one might not work for the other. And these publishers that's putting these books out, you know what I'm saying? They're selling and they're doing hella numbers. They don't have no incentive to do paperbacks at all. You know what I'm saying? Because the money is all right there. Now for the artist that's doing the paperbacks, and you know what I'm saying? That's their avenue. You know what I'm saying? So what worked for one might not necessarily work for the other. You know, there's no particular right or wrong. And we looking at Amazon like, you know, like they, I mean, this, you know, like they the, you know, the 800-pound gorilla in the room or whatever to speak. You know what I'm saying? To use that term. But really, Amazon is not the problem. It goes back to what we were talking about with them allowing all these different books to come out that's of poor quality.
Right.
You know? And you know, you got readers. It goes back to the readers. You read the reviews and say, well, the book had, you know, it was this, it was some inconsistencies, but I'm still go back and I'm going to pick up part two just because I want to see what happens. Well, you pay 99 cents for part two, but you're going to pay $4.99 for part one, but you're going to pay $4.99 for part two. Just because you want to see what happens, in spite of what you said about the quality on the first book. So the books are selling. So, you know what I'm saying? So the authors that's writing these books don't have no incentive to change their game because the books are selling anyway. When it becomes a money grab, you know what I'm saying? When it becomes a money grab, that's when the problem come in, and that's what tanks the industry.
Gotcha.
I agree. Anybody want to add something?
No, he made some very, very good points.
He made good points. No, you're registering that.
Hold on. All right. All right, clicking my ink pen, taking notes.
Well, we want
to
go ahead.
While we have the moment, not to switch subjects, but I guess this will be a good time to send our thoughts and prayers out to Tanisha Sincere, who's her father today.
Right. And Otisia Johnson, whose mother is in the hospital right now as well. So we want to keep both of those families in our prayers. And remember, if you are in the Atlanta area, Jody and I will be there. I promise to be on my best behavior. I can't say what Jody's going to do. But we'll be at Nubian Books in Morrow, Georgia, 1540 South Lake Parkway. And we want to thank Michael Carter and Mary Green, Jacqueline, Thomas, Great Uncle Pat, Clever Black, and Maurice for being on the show tonight. Yay! Thank you all so much. Thank you. We're going to go ahead and we're going to close it out because I know people are ready to get to bed.
All right.
Hit it.
Only touch the records that I